cliffcentral.com. Richard, are we on track with the financial pack for my presentation to the board next week?
Well, hopefully. The team's very short-staffed, and it's taking such a long time to find a suitable financial manager for the division. We're way behind on all our forecasts and reporting.
Why don't you speak to the finance team? They're a consultancy that can help you with an experienced interim financial manager. You can have somebody to help you almost immediately. They'll hit the ground running with no long-term contracts and no upfront placement fees.
Go to thefinanceteam.co.za.
Welcome to our business section of our Business Masterclass. I'm Richard Angus, CEO of the Finance Team, your part-time financial executive solution. Joining me in studio today is Safia Boulay of New Habits, Making Shift Happen.
How's it, Richard?
Last week, we spoke to Elizabeth Vasquez, President, CEO, and co-founder of WeConnect International, and Jean Chawapiwa, Country Director for WeConnect International. A great interview that was. Yeah, it was a really great one. Download the podcast from our website. Today, we have the CEO of Auto Trader, George Minnie, with us.
How's it, Angus? I must say, I like that. That hit me as well. I like that name, Making Shift Happen. It's really good play on words.
Yeah. So, George, we've been chatting, and Ryan Tucker has stayed on with us from RM Tucker Attorneys. We've been chatting about the whole world of intellectual property, and as the CEO of Auto Trader with a brand out there and intellectual property galore, I'm sure you've had great experience with the world of intellectual property and some of the challenges of running an online business and managing that. Perhaps just as a starting point, I mean, Auto Trader, how long has Auto Trader been going now?
A good 25 years.
Okay. Started off in the publishing space.
Print magazine. Was built to about a 600-page weekly magazine. We used to distribute and sell about 110,000 magazines a month back in about 2007.
Okay.
And then the internet happened, and we became an internet business, and we just, at the end of March, we actually shut the Auto Trader magazine. That was the last one.
Wow.
That's a bit of a bittersweet time.
Oh, that's definitely an evolution of business.
Yes.
Now, over that period of time, obviously the business has shifted, and the way you do business has fundamentally changed. What has happened from a, let's call it, intellectual property and brand perspective as you've moved? Because, I mean, the reality is print media, and you've got your brand and you can position, and you're in control fundamentally.
Yeah.
You get into the world of online and suddenly things start shifting very quickly. Mm. What has your experience been in that space around how your brand appears and potentially intellectual property issues that you've run into?
So it becomes a lot muddier on the internet. Mm. That's our experience. It becomes a lot muddier. We've experienced in the world of the internet and post the magazine days, we've experienced scenarios where people use the Auto Trader brand and its trademarks, and sometimes not even knowing that they're crossing any lines. I mean, I'm of the habit now of phoning up the CEO of whoever's contravening what they're not supposed to be doing, and just saying to him, listen, you're infringing on our trademark, you're infringing on our brand and our CI. Can you stop doing it? I don't want to waste money on, not that you guys are a waste of money. I don't want to spend money on lawyers unnecessarily. But can you stop doing it? And 9 times out of 10, they actually, a back off. Mm. We had a case about 4 months ago where we've actually stopped publishing a magazine called Auto Freeway, but we still have the trademark on Auto Freeway.
Okay.
And we still redirect autofreeway.co.za to Auto Trader, and we've stopped publishing that magazine about 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And somebody used the coloring, used the term in Durban, and launched a magazine. So I just rang him up and I said to him, are you aware that we have this trademark? We still derive value out of it, and can you please pull your magazine off the shelf? And they changed the name of the magazine and they changed the coloring.
Mm. Now, just out of interest, I mean, when you had that conversation, did he actually, did they intentionally go and pirate I guess, or copy?
I think they did, but I don't think they were doing it maliciously. I think this particular scenario was one where he had realized that we had shut the magazine because we could put communication out that we're shutting the magazine. We become more of an online business, and that maybe this was, you know, not crossing a line. And, you know, he's an entrepreneur. You know, entrepreneurs don't have a lot of money. They want to put all their money into the commercial aspects of the business, and probably didn't realize what he was doing.
It's what Ryan called squatting.
Yeah. Ryan had that that term. He said, people squat on your domain. I always thought people that were squatting was, you know, Prevention of Illegal Eviction Act and all of this. And suddenly we're into this world.
In the
cyber world. I mean, I guess, yeah, Ryan, I mean, your experience here comes into play. I mean,
yeah, I'd love to ask a question.
Sure.
You know, I'm sure you've heard of the Clearview case. And I wanted to know if you do use Google AdWords,
yes,
and how that case has impacted your strategy around internet marketing for your brand.
Okay, so Ryan, let's not make the assumption all the listeners have heard about it. Just give us a summary of what happened in that case.
Okay, so basically there were two parties. There was Clearview and M Systems. Clearview are those guys that produce those fences.
Oh, which, that you can see through.
Correct.
Okay. Yes.
So, obviously, they'd filed a trademark for it, but they hadn't gotten registration yet. M Systems decided to use Google Ads, and they basically took Clearview, which is the brand or trademark of that business, and used it as a keyword. For Google AdWords.
Okay.
And the court, it went all the way up to the Supreme Court of Appeal. And the Supreme Court of Appeal said, in line with European and Canadian law, that internet users are savvy people. They understand the difference between Google AdWords and normal advertising, and that the fact that they had keyed in the word Clearview and received advertising material from M Systems, they were still able to discern the difference between the products. So I don't think it's a particularly good judgment in my view, in my personal opinion, but I mean, I'm going up against the European Court of Justice, the UK Court of Appeal, the South African Supreme Court of Appeal now, and recently the Canadian courts. But basically the end result was that M Systems was allowed to use Clearview's trademark as a Google AdWord keyword.
So that Clearview case is an exact example of what we went through not so long ago. And in our industry, everybody is bidding on each other's brand terms. There is only one rule that Google imposes on you when you want to bid on another brand term, whether that brand term is trademarked or not trademarked. There's only one rule, and that is don't pass off as that brand, which means you can buy the keyword Auto Trader, but you're not allowed to make the user think that you're Auto Trader.
Yeah.
In the copy of the ad itself, you have to pose as yourself. You can't pose as Auto Trader. And we were in court up to probably a couple of months ago where somebody had sued us for doing exactly that. And we prepared our case, and we thought we had a really, really strong case. And on the 11th hour, our opponents pulled out and withdrew the case. I think they saw the Clearview result and some of the European results, and now it's rife. It's absolutely rife. So it is allowed, whether rightly or wrongly so. I mean, I think the future court cases are gonna establish that, but it is something that happens in this industry a lot. Now, on the flip side, though, you've got to juxtapose doing that with the cost of doing it. Because when we bid on another competitor's brand term, we pay a lot of money for that, whereas bidding on our own brand term costs us in the lower single digits. So when we buy Auto Trader as a brand term, we pay maybe 2 rand. Whereas when someone else bids on AutoTrader's brand term, they're going to be paying 30, 40, 50 rand per click. So Google sorts the men out from the boys in that way, especially when, you know, you filed with Google, because we filed with Google that we own the trademark, we own the brand. So if anybody else bids on it, you know, they're bidding on our brand term.
Yeah. Now, how do you make sure that Google's aware of that? I mean, what's the process for, I mean, I must admit, I didn't know that you could actually register your trademark with them. How do you go through that process?
So they've got a set of forms that you have to go through and complete. You have to submit your trademark to them, and there's a process that you have to go through to get it.
I think that's a real practical insight from the show, because
especially from a consumer point of view.
Yeah, because I think it's really important that people realize that if you don't do that, potentially. Yeah, well, I suppose it's difficult for somebody else to do it, but I mean, you could very well find yourself bidding against others who are bidding on your name, and next minute you're paying the $50 for your own name.
Yeah. Well, I think you had the advantage is you already had a registered trademark, whereas Clearview didn't, and they had to rely on passing off in their case.
Okay,
so it's slightly a different scenario, although the general basic principles are the same.
Yeah. Now, I mean, let's talk a little about how we move, and let's move from, let's call it the brand or the intellectual property, into this whole question of brand name. I mean, your brand is synonymous in the auto industry, and everybody knows who we're talking about. But what happens when people try and confuse that brand and trade off that brand in a way, shape, or form? I mean, how aggressively can you? I mean, do you pursue people aggressively? I mean, you've spoken about making those phone calls. Do people actually try and do the, let's call it the brand hijack often?
Yes. So, well, in the world of the internet, again, what we find is, and again, I phoned up these CEOs, and you know, one guy didn't want to listen, so we institute legal proceedings to try and get them to stop doing it. But in the code of their technology, they use subtle changes and the term auto trader, where you can't see it, the public, from a public point of view, you can't see it, but it's there. But Google can read it, and it helps them. So we've had situations like that where organically people use auto trader's brand term to try and get up the Google rankings. And when we do realize it, we approach it in exactly the same way. We approach it in a nice way. We phone the people up and say, listen, you know, this is what we're doing. Here's screenshots. We can see it. Please stop. And if not, then we do start to pursue it aggressively. I think if you're a trademark owner or a brand owner, if you don't attack every solitary infringement, this is just our approach, if you don't attack every solitary infringement, then you leave yourself open at some point down the line for some guy to bring that up and say, but hold on a second, you didn't attack him, so why are you attacking me? So therefore it's okay for some people to use your brand term.
It's almost if you don't defend each and every instance, it's kind of a concession made, open sesame sort of scenario.
Acquiescence.
So in the world of the internet, we are finding it a lot more than what we did in the print days, because particularly because of technology, and people want to get up Google rankings. And the way to get up Google rankings is go and use a brand term that has a domain authority of almost 50. And squat.
Yeah, you know, you've started something. that just brings up bad images of little tin shacks on the side of your internet.
My image is a bit worse than that.
No, don't go there. You're from Cape Town. No, I mean, okay, so you've built now a business that is totally online. That means you've got IP inside your environment, inside your people. And it's now a very intangible part of how you do business. Let's talk, and we wanted to get to this whole question earlier of what happens about the intellectual property that sits in the minds of your people that now create the IP that becomes your brand. Where's that line, and how do you manage as a business that line between the IP of your people and the IP of the organization? How have you gone about managing that?
So we think we've morphed with in the way that we need to in our employment contracts, mm-hmm. and in the way in which we lay claim to that IP.
Okay.
And then on and then a layer on top of that is restraints of trade. Mm-hmm. So we have restraints of trade on top of owning any IP that somebody comes up with during their tenure at Auto Trader. So if you come up with something at Auto Trader, it's owned by Auto Trader. You can't go afterwards and go and use it to build a business, because you probably got all the tools and all of the insights and input that you've needed in order to come up with what whatever you came up with at the time that you were working there. So our employment contracts are a vital part of protecting that IP, especially when that employee leaves the organization.
Mm. Yeah, I was going to say, it's one thing to protect IP inside your organization. It's another thing when it walks out the door with a 30-day notice and 100%. suddenly you've got a challenge. Naran, you were mentioning earlier how important this is, and I think it's important. I mean, you're a developed and established business, but you come from a place, and as your business grows, the people that are sitting there are creating this IP, but you employed them back, well, let's call it on day three of your business startup. So just give, Ryan, if I can ask you, what is the sort of insight that an entrepreneur needs to have as they're starting their business? And I always laugh. We always used to say, so what is this person's employee number? But when they've got employee number, 003 or 005, they were there from day one.
Yeah.
And their employment contract is the very first one that you got, and you probably picked it up off.
Didn't have an employment contract.
Or even worse, they didn't have an employment contract. They were just given a payslip and told, there's stuff to do, let's make it happen. What are the important things that one needs to make sure is in that contract to protect your IP?
I'll let you answer, but then I'll tell you what we do practically from time to time.
Okay.
That is, I think, important to do in any business.
Okay, let's do that.
I think that, first of all, the employee's role and the types of actions that he or she has to do in the business need to be very specifically detailed. And if necessary, an intellectual property related clause needs to be inserted in there. I was talking earlier about the South African Weather Services case, which dealt with a scenario of copyright in software. The claimant, who was a ex-member of the South African Weather Services, he produced software outside of the course and scope of his employment, so he said. He did it after hours and other elements similar to that. But the court ultimately said that the job that he was required to do entailed some of the aspects that he did after hours. So notwithstanding the fact that his defense was that it was after hours, it still related to the core employment requirements that was required of him by the South African Weather Service. So they sided with the Weather Service, and that software program was then owned by the Weather Service. So that's the sort of level of the requirement, I think, that needs to go into your employment contracts. I don't know what you actually do in order to enforce that type of level of protection.
Well, I mean,
well,
I think
I was going to say, let's listen to the practical solution.
The practical solution is not as easy, but you have something at your disposal when it comes to the Labor Relations Act, and that is called the consultation. And in order for the business to operationally continue, you can consult with that employee and change the conditions of their employment. And the Labor Relations Act allows for that to happen. So if you see a loophole in your intellectual property parts of your contracts, just enter into a consultation process with that employee and be transparent and upfront and make the changes. And that's what we do and have done from time to time over the years, is where we see where our intellectual property or our our IP is going to get infringed or potentially infringed because there is a flaw in something, we'll enter into a consultation process if it's employee number two.
So ex post facto, let me say that I'm not a labor expert, so my comments do come with that rider.
Well, you know, I'm not saying that it's always successful because I'm not a lawyer myself, but I can just tell you the practical things that we do.
And I think that that's the reality, that practically you've got to resolve the problem. I think sticking your head in the sand and ignoring it only becomes a 30-day notice, oh, we have a crisis problem further down the track. So a consultation and an engagement, I think, is a practical way to start.
No, and it's not a negative consultation. It's not like you kind of, you know, you sit down with the individual and you say to them, listen, yeah, this is the scenario. We need to protect this business. What do you think? This is what we're proposing. And then you give the person an opportunity to give their side of the story.
Yeah. And particularly if it's done before it becomes an issue.
Yes.
And I mean, anybody who's normally working for you is quite happy that, you know, where the rights sit at a point.
Yeah.
It's when they leave that they obviously potentially have different views on the subject.
Well, have the fight before the divorce.
Yes. Agree what you're going to do with the cats and the dogs before it becomes a challenge.
I just marvel at the fact that you're able to have those consultations and enter into that process, because it means that you've got a degree of vigilance in the business about what people are busy with.
We do, and as a tech company, you have to, I think.
I was going to say, I think you've picked up on a very important part there of knowing and being close enough to your business to know when IP is being generated and who's impacted by that IP generation.
And whether or not there's a loophole.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, and as Angus pointed out, we're a mature business already. So you know, we have legal people looking at our business on an ongoing basis. For a startup entrepreneur, I would think it's a lot more difficult.
Mm. Yeah, it has its huge challenges. Now, George, I mean, you've had the ability to step back and look at a business as it's changed. I mean, has it become harder to protect your rights from an intellectual property perspective in the, let's call it, the new age versus the print media space? Or have the challenges just shifted? Has it been a shifting of challenge, or has the complexity of a digital age really, like, let's call it, escalated the elements of intellectual property protection and the challenges around that?
I think the latter. So I don't think anything's changed in terms of the principles from what, you know, I've been at the business for 14 years and we've faced similar challenges in the first 7 to the last 10. Should I say 25 years in the last 10 years versus the 15 years before that in print. So I don't think the principles have changed. It's just got a lot busier.
It's all happening a lot faster.
It's happening a lot faster. You've got a lot more infringements. You've got a lot more to watch. You've got a lot more to be cognizant of, and they come at you a lot more often and with speed.
Yeah, it always strikes me that, and the one thing, and I want to just go back to something that we did talk about is, in closing, I mean, you've got the word auto trader. Those are two words that are not unique, I guess, to our earlier question. How did you manage to, because I mean, the principle is simply, I guess, you've got two fairly common words, auto, trader, those are English words. How did you manage to combine those and then protect those in that? Is it just because of the unique combination of the auto trader that gave you that ability to trademark it?
I think so. I'm not a lawyer, as I said. So, you know, I can just take what we've learnt through the practical experience, and I think it's because of the uniqueness of the combination of the words that it's protectable. We've got it registered in a number of classes, not just one, and I think our country, you know, takes its guide from what I've seen from the international first world countries, and this trademark and brand has been protected in other countries as well. As Auto Trader, we've even got trademarks in a lot of the African countries. I wouldn't say majority because I wouldn't know whether it's a majority or not, but we've sought out to protect it in Africa. Mm-hmm. So we've got a lot of trademarks registered there as well.
Okay.
And we've got it right. So it is a protectable name. There are a lot of others that aren't.
Mm. Yeah, clearly. And I mean, we talked about the challenge of having a, you know, plumber Joburg in the previous show, and like, well, how are you going to protect that? You know, so you've got to be really, you know, think about your naming convention and that uniqueness to make sure that it is protectable and that you actually can do something with that brand.
Or come up with a strange word like Twitter.
or Google.
The more inventive, the better.
The more inventive, the better, yeah. And we also did a comment on how that uniqueness suddenly becomes a verb further down the line, you know. I mean, the concept of Google was foreign, but nowadays we just say, I Googled this,
yes,
and it's a verb.
Exactly.
And everybody knows what you're talking about.
I mean, I don't know if this is of any interest to you, but more and more your domain name is not playing as big a part in your being able to be found through Google. It's playing less and less of a role in Google's algorithm. So if you don't have the name that's being searched for in the URL, it isn't as important a big deal as it was 10 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. George, thank you very much for your time. Your insights are invaluable. It's really great
to talk. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's really great to talk to somebody about a practical subject like this, because I think often intellectual property is seen as this out there thing that only the lawyers and the guys behind closed doors deal with. And you've had a very practical business experience with it. So we really appreciate your insights.
And a pleasure. Thank you
very much for that. Next up, the Youth Leadership Platform. CliffCentral.com.